You're listening to Coach Life.
This episode is brought to you by Play by Matrika Sports, the fundamental tool for every coach and analyst. Create and manage all your video analysis in one platform, from coding the game to player sharing. Play by Matrika Sports is the most intuitive and easy to use platform out there. It can be useful not only for football, but to any sport or individual that wants to improve performance and utilise video analysis for that. Code key moments of the game, analyse and share them with staff and players. It's free, and any team in the world is able to cover the whole workflow to improve team performance. Code, visualise and present in just a few seconds. Create your free account now at matrikasports.com. Play by Matrika Sports, the power behind the game. Just very quickly, before we get into the episode, the app that I'm using to record these episodes with is having a few problems, and it's sounding brilliant when we're recording, but when we finish and the guest has gone, you then find out that there was an overlap between my voice and their voice, which isn't good enough. So I'm going to find a different way to record going forward. Because it's not good enough. People don't want to hear that, and it needs to be right. But there's so much content in this episode, you know, give it a listen. So, Tom, where did it all begin for you then regarding football? Did you play when you were younger? Did you play all the way through, you know, till you're a coach now? Or tell me a bit about you and football.
I've always been interested in football, but I was late coming as a player. I've always been quite an academic in general. So I've always been someone that has been a lot more confident thinking and analysing rather than doing. And I probably started playing for my first grassroots team when I was 12 or 13. There was a lot of reasons for that. One of it was my family weren't huge football people. In the sense that they weren't my mum and dad weren't the type of parents that where the whole weekend was centred around sport. My dad tended to work away quite a lot from Monday to Friday. So the weekend tended to be a lot of family time and a lot about us as a four. I've got a younger brother. But when I was about 10, my mum started working on Saturdays. And my younger brother then, his friendship group were into football. So he used to go and dad then used to take him to Saturday morning football sessions. And I used to then just, you know, bobble about on the sideline and join in a little bit. And then through a holiday to Turkey, where we were with family, friends and family, and we ended up, I got shoved in goal because basically I was the only one that was stupid enough not to be quick enough to not go in goal. I basically went in goal and I did all right. And they were like, oh, you should definitely play football when you get back home. So I sort of asked my parents about it. And obviously, since my brother was doing it, it was like, well, we could train at the same time. And I went from sort of going grassroots at 12, 13, I think under 13s was the first age group I did, to being a county goalkeeper by the time I was under 15s in Dorset. Wow. And I got a trial at Southampton when I was 16. So it sort of was a massive spring. But what I did then realise from that trial was that I was never going to be at the level where I was going to be professional. And I was all right with that. I had no real ambition to be that. I just enjoyed playing football and I enjoyed being in goal and I enjoyed the things that came with it, like, you know, spending time with your mates and having that friendship and camaraderie in the group. Now, parallel to this, I said obviously that was quite academic. When I was about 12 years old, Nestle's were doing a game demo thing with their cereals. So all the cereal packets, you got a free CD demo. When I was about 12-ish, we used to buy Shreddies in our family, and there was a Red Championship Manager 2001, 2002 demo disc,
Yes, yeah, I
and
remember.
I
Yeah.
fell in love with it. I absolutely loved it. I loved the thought of tactics and again the analytical side, the trying to find players and everything around then really sort of grabbed my focus in terms of football, seeing it from the other side, not just the playing side and all the skills you can do, but the sort of the tactics and the analytical side. So I had that in the back of my head. And then when I was 16, as part of the county team, we all got given the chance to go on a level one course for free. And that sort of awoke a few things in me in terms of the mechanics of being a coach. So being a leader, setting up an exercise or a drill, my sort of natural enthusiasm came out all of a sudden a bit more. I never really knew how to do that in a social setting, but somehow in a coaching setting with the environment that you created yourself, I felt like I could be me more. I could express myself easier. So things just kind of fell into place. And then I did my level two when I was 18 before I went to university, because that for me was a big thing. And I was still playing football at the time. I used to sort of train in the morning, and then I used to coach a grassroots team straight after my own session. And then I would either go and play, or I'd play and then go and coach the team I was coaching, or I'd go and help my brother's team. Or so all of a sudden I was sort of being parallel player and a coach when I was sort of 16, 17, 18. And then when I went to university, I started work for the Fulham Foundation. So I did a lot of like PPA sessions, after school sessions, holidays, school sessions, that sort of thing. And I probably worked the equivalent of a full-time job in my first year, and then kind of did uni on the side, even though it should have been the other way. And then when I was in my second year at uni, I was playing in the university teams at the time. I didn't really play non-league, but playing the university teams. And then in my second year, I broke my finger. I was a keeper, obviously, so that's a bit crucial. And I sort of broke it in a way that was not normal. It was a freezing cold January day. I remember making a save with the ball. I caught it on a dive, and something didn't feel right. And I just sort of thought I'd bent my finger back or something. So I just carried on for probably 5, 10 minutes. It just wouldn't go away. So I took my glove off, and my finger was not in the direction it should be. So then I ended up going to A&E. And 2 days later, having two screws put in it, but the rehab afterwards didn't quite go to plan, which then meant I had to have another operation. So I ended up having sort of 6 to 9 months of not really playing, when at the same time then my coaching sort of not took off, but I took a grassroots team up there in London where I was studying, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. And it got to a point then again where I was like, would you know what? Playing football just doesn't do it for me anymore. I much prefer coaching. I much prefer the mechanics of that, and working with players and watching other people play and helping them in that way, than I do actually myself playing. So it was probably around that time that coaching really got serious, and I'm sure we'll touch on what happened after that. But that's sort of how I fell in love with football. I'm a Southampton fan by sin, so there's been I'm used to not necessarily seeing all the brighter days all the time. But that I think has also given me quite a realistic view on football, that it has different romanticisms. It doesn't have to always be about the best way to play or young players in your team, or that feeling of overachieving is something that I quite like when it comes to football.
Yeah, I know exactly where you're coming from. I mean, Southampton are a great club. As a coach, I admire them and what they do. And there's a great, you've probably seen it. There's a great video with the academy director about what they do and how they treat them on the pitch, but also they give them like their own little apartment. They give them an allowance per week or whatever, and the academy boys are taught life skills basically,
And it's I really enjoyed that watch. I think it was about an hour's program. I'll have to try and dig it up and share the link.
It's a good club, Southampton. As I say, I think it's lost its way. It always, like any club, it goes through cycles. Obviously, 10 years ago when it had Koeman come in and Pochettino around that time, it had a real clarity about it, about what it wanted to do. And I should say, it starts with Nigel Atkins before that.
Yes.
So when they were League One, before they got to Premier League. And then he felt like it took another step when Pochettino came in, and then he felt like it took another step when Koeman came in. Then it kind of lost its way a bit, but now with Hasselhoeven, you feel like it's starting to come back to what it was about, which is, it's not just about young players coming in, but it's about that it's more than just the football. It's the feeling that they create with the football and the identity that the fans feel to the team. And I think, you know, if win, lose or draw, then you always have more empathy then with the team, rather than just if you had teams that run a lot of big wages and you spent big money on that actually don't do it every week and don't have that same affinity with the fans, which is what I think happened 5-6 years ago.
So fast forward to when you said you were with a grassroots team in London and you sort of thought, yeah, I fancy a bit of this full time. What was your next step then, and the process of sort of making that a reality?
Well, at the same time as being at university, after my first year, I pretty much worked the whole summer in London doing all the holiday football schools that they did. And they always used to be held at the stadium, Craven Cottage. And we used to have all the meet up in the stand at the stadium, and then Bishop's Park was the park right next door to the stadium. So you sort of walked 2 minutes down to the pitches, did the sessions and then walked back. And I did that basically for the whole summer. And one of the weeks there was a Norwegian father with his son and his son's best friend from the same team in Norway that come over to basically have a holiday in London. They were going to meet the Risa brothers, John Arne Risa and Bjørn Helge Risa, who were both at Fulham at the time. It was the year 2010. So it was the year that Fulham got to the Europa League final.
Yeah.
So that was another, you know, great experience to look at and see. But these Norwegian kids were in my training group, and I had no idea. I knew Norway was somewhere in a generic direction towards Scotland, and it was cold occasionally, but I could probably tell the capital was Oslo, and it was a red, blue and white flag, but that was about it. I didn't really know a lot else. So it was a really nice challenge to have to construct a session then, knowing that you couldn't just talk it. You had to be creative in how you wanted to get your ideas across. So it was a lot of play orientated. It was a lot of them being sort of captains. It was a lot of showing them with either actions on the pitch or with a board and a pen, or, you know, trying to get contact with them in a different way. Their English was actually very good, considering my Norwegian was terrible. So they understood a lot more than I'd planned for. But the father really appreciated the fact that I took the energy and was being a bit creative. And around that time, I was 20 at the time, I had this romantic idea to basically go down the spine of Europe and find out as much about football as I could from all different cultures, because I was starting to understand from watching La Liga on Saturday and Sunday evenings on Sky Sports and the Premier League and catching the odd French game or Champions League, that football was very different in different cultures. And the culture, even then, it was starting to realize that culture was a really important factor to consider. So I wrote a lot of letters to a lot of different clubs all across Europe when I was sort of summer of me being 19. I got some responses, but very little. But this father very kindly invited me to Norway and basically said that, just let me know when you can come over, and I'll happily look after you. You know, you can happily stay in the spare room, and, you know, we'll try and get some links to some clubs in Norway. So I worked for another year. After my second year in university, I went to to Norway. I went to Oslo, and that was 2011. And basically, we spent 2 weeks, me and a friend of mine. And the first week, we went to see four or five Norwegian Premier Division teams, watched them train, and on occasions, we actually got to meet the manager and have a proper conversation. So when we went to Lillestrøm, for example, the manager at Lillestrøm was Henning Berg. So we had probably 15, 20 minutes talking about his session, talking about his philosophy, talking about, how and why they did what they did. And then we had the sports director tell us about the club, and then we had the head of academy tell us about the academy. So straight away, we realized that football in Norway and in Scandinavia was very open. They're very open to sharing ideas. There wasn't really very much secrets, and that things were accessible. So we went to see a lot of different clubs, and then about the end of the first week, we went to the local semi-pro team, and they were called Follow, and they were managed by a guy called Hans Erik Eriksson, and they had another guy there called Axel Bergo, who have gone on to do big things, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. But we went there, and it was one of those things where they presented the club to us. They got to the cup final as a relegated championship team, so they were in the division below, have got relegated from the division below, but got to the cup final that year, beat Rosenborg in an infamous game in the semi-final. And Rosenborg were obviously one of the biggest teams in Norway, regularly played Champions League football at that time. It was the year, no, it wasn't the year after. It was a couple of years after they'd got Jose Mourinho sacked from Chelsea the first time he'd been there. And they were the first coaches then to sit down and say, "So tell us about you." So it was like I explained that I was from working for Fulham in the Football Foundation, and my friend Rob, he worked for Arsenal Football Schools at the time. And it was one of those then where they just sort of, we used to then have the routine for the second half of the week. We did a couple of days coaching on like a private football academy with the local kids. And then we probably used to have the routine where we spend the morning doing this and that. We'd go and watch training at 3 o'clock, and then we would then spend an hour and a half after training, sat down with the manager and Axel, who was like the under 19s coach, talking football for probably about a week. It was brilliant. Absolutely. One of the best memories of my sort of university career was that 2 weeks away. And then time went on, and we roughly kept in contact with everybody. And then just before the turn of the year into 2012, I got a message from Axel saying that they'd hired a Portuguese coach called Hugo Pereira, and he was coming in to take over as the under 19s head coach and was going to head the sort of football school side of it. And he said that their first football school they'd planned was for the half term in February, and would me and Robbie should come over and coach and be there as a coach, and they would look after, pay for flights, they'd look after us while we were there. And we would get the experience. And I probably responded with about 10 seconds saying, "Hell yeah." So I went there with Rob in February 2012, stayed with Hugo on his floor, on an airbed, and actually loved the week. We had 5 days of coaching, sort of, I think it was between 8 and 12 year olds. Language was obviously a problem, but we had like Norwegian assistants, and at the same time, then I was trying to learn the language, well, not language, but like 1 to 10 and key football phrases and things like that. And then I went back over in, I think it was the end of June, to do another sort of, I got invited again. And on that time, they said, "We're looking to start a under 14s and 15s team in our academy," because the Norwegian model traditionally is that from the ages of 8 to 16, most players stay in their club, and then it used to go like under 16, under 19, reserve team, first team. That's changed now, but at the time that's how it was. So for Follow then to extend their academy was a bit of a big thing. So they said, "Would you be interested?" And that was around about the time I was graduating from uni. So I was like, "Yes, definitely." And then I didn't really think about it. I just sort of said, "Yeah, I'd be interested." But again, there were so many things that had to happen for it to to come off that I didn't really give it much thought. And I was, you know, looking for jobs in England. And I sort of told myself when I finish uni, I'm going to have to give myself a year, try and find a football job. And if it doesn't work, then I'm going to go back to uni, do a teaching degree and be a teacher and go down that line. And then I got an official offer beginning of November, moved out January 2013. And at the time, I didn't really think anything about it. People have asked me since, like, well, how did you find the move and what do you think? And I said to them, I didn't think about it. The only thing I thought at the time was I'm going to go and work full time in football. How cool is that? I didn't think about moving away from home. I didn't think about a new country or culture. I had a girlfriend at the time. I didn't really think about the fact that we were going to be long distance. It was just the case of this is what I want to do. And I sort of did it. And it's only now in years that have gone on then when you look back at it that you realise how absolutely bonkers it was as a 21-year-old to move to a country that you hadn't really been there that often to go and start a new life, basically.
It takes balls to do that, doesn't it?
It does now.
At that age.
I've done it and I'm still here to tell the tale. But as I said, at the time, it wasn't a thought. The thought was I'm going to work in football and the people I'm going to work for were really good people. And it was just what I wanted to do.
I'm just going to pick up on something you said earlier. You said how open Norway were as a nation to you coming in, wanting to just basically talk about football and what they do, their ideas. And talking in the previous episode to Brian, he got the same feeling. Do you think in this country, and I'm not sort of saying everybody's like it, but do you think we're too secretive in England over football and, you know, what this club's doing? No. We can't promote what we're doing because everyone will copy us and they'll get ahead.
I think the challenge with England is that the commercial and media side is of such a different level to Scandinavia that you can understand more why in England it is like it is. I don't think it's right. I completely agree with your statement. And I think that it's become a bit to detriment of coach education in general and for people to understand why things are, given the mixing pot of cultures and backgrounds and nationalities of coaching staff in England now. But I think that the economics in England are so astronomical that you don't go many weeks where you hear about things happening between agents, players and clubs, or clubs tapping up players. So I think there's so much financial stakes in England compared to Norway. Whereas in Norway or Scandinavia in general, they believe a lot about socialism. And that's very much a case of everyone should have the same opportunity to do pretty much everything. So things like differentiation is still a relatively grey area here. They believe in it if you're on the right side of it, and they don't believe in it if you're not on the right side of it, or if it's certain sports over others. So it's the difference in culture. I think that's the biggest factor. But I think that the business economics and that side of it in England has a massive impact on then why people are so skeptical as they are.
Yeah, I think you're right. I just when you think of Pep coming over to Man City, and he's so open with his ideas, he'll almost sometimes tell you what he's going to do or how they're going to play. And the same with Barcelona. They're so open for such a big club. They're so open with what they do and what they believe in. And their sort of feeling is, well, you might copy us, but we're always going to be better.
I think the thing that coaches overlook, and this is a very generalized statement now, so I'll explain it a little bit after. But I think the attitude a lot of clubs have is exactly because they can give you all the resources, the philosophies, the training exercises, the periodization, and give you all those resources. What they can't give you is the personality or the culture behind that. So things like routines, things like what is acceptable on the pitch, what's not acceptable on the pitch, where does the bar sit? What are the standards of that group of players or coaches? And that at the end tends to be the difference. So I think that they are open yeah. because the methodology is I wouldn't say it's not a secret, because you could probably Google it and it's there, or versions of it. But I think the yeah. mechanics behind it and the culture, I think those countries, because again, they have a very strong cultural base, that they understand that the culture is something that you can't necessarily replicate ideally or identically, that you have to build upon it and build your own culture and combine the two. I think that's where England go a little bit wrong, because as I say, it's very business orientated, it's very financial orientated, rather than having a more cultural basis like the Spanish or the Latin countries tend to have.
So fast forwarding again to when you took the under 14 job, where did you, how long were you there, and where did you go from there?
So within a week of me getting there, Axel, who I mentioned earlier, turned around to me and said, you've got goalkeeper qualification, haven't you? I was like, yeah. He was like, do you fancy doing some sessions with the first team? Now, you've got to remember, I'm 21 at this time, and I've done goalkeeper sessions for a variety of ages and people, but this is for a team that were at the second level of Norwegian football and were playing against some rather big boys. So I was like, yeah, I can do that. And again, the goalkeeper I was working with, one of them at least, was older than me. So I had to really fight hard to win his trust and be very open with the dialogue I had with him in terms of how he liked to work and what my ideas were and things like that. And then within the space of 3 months, there was a website article saying that I was now head of goalkeeping. So within the space of 3 months, I've gone from having the under 14s to having the under 14s and pretty much every goalkeeper in the club and having all the after school sessions and everything. That's how they made it into a full-time role. But I loved it because it was just on the grass, and there was a lot of time on the grass. And I know that when you talk about coaching at the time, at that time, people just thought if you did 30 hours a week, that 30 hours of it should be on the grass. And that neglects obviously the planning and reflecting and setting up things and traveling to things. So it was very full on, but I had 3 great years at that club. And the 2013, or class of 2013, as I would call it, of coaches there was unbelievable for a club that was, like I say, a part-time second tier team in Norway. The coaches had gone into that, or that were there, that got on to amazing things, was just incredible. So I'm going to discount myself as being incredible, but the fact I'm still in Norway, I see as an achievement. The under-15s coach was Axel, who I mentioned earlier. He was the assistant manager for the under-21s national team for, I think it was 4 years. He worked in the top football centre, which is like a centre to the side of the Football Federation, which looks at best practice and works on all the national youth leagues or competence of coaches or things around basically the elite side of football from top to bottom. He now works as a consultant for the women's game in Norway. The under-16s coach was a local coach, but a very, very nice coach, very good person and very well reflected in the group. The under-19s coach is now under-19s coach in a club called Kristiansund. Went on to become manager in Follo a few years later. He is now an analyst and assistant for the national under-18s team in Norway. The head coach for the under-19s, Hugo Pereira, has just left a role as the assistant manager of the Colombian national team to Carlos Queiroz.
Wow.
And had gone on to be assistant in Follo as well. And he worked as assistant in Rosenborg for 2 years and worked in Rosenborg's youth setup as well. And then we had a player who was doing some of the academy coaching, or sorry, not academy coaching, like after school coaching. He's now an assistant manager in a club called Odd in the top league. The under 15s coach who was there as well was in Sporting Lisbon before. And there was a player coach, and the coach part of it was at all levels. He's now the head coach of Benfica's under 23s. So considering we were, and I have to say, like, we were not a rich club by any means. It was not like someone, we didn't have a sugar daddy that threw money at it. It was just the fact that this mix of people came and wanted an adventure. And the coaching competence that year was unbelievable. I learned so much as a wet behind the ears coach. And then I stayed there until 2015. So I was 3 years there, followed the 14s up till they went to, they were about to begin under 19s. And that was when the group then split. Some were kept on to be 19s. Some went in different directions. I forgot, obviously, the manager, sorry, Hans-Erik Eriksson. He's now assistant for the under 19s national team. And as he won like young coach of the year, and he's a lot of my personality or coaching personality comes from him, because he was very un-Norwegian at the time. He was very democratic, very guided in the way he coached, very showed a lot of empathy. That's the word. Empathic is the word.
So I just want to jump in with a question. So you were 21 when you took the under 14 team. So that is quite a, let's say, little brother, big brother sort of age. How did you feel? How did the players respect you? And, you know, did they love it because you were nearer their age? Or did you get a bit of friction and a bit of, you know, I'm struggling for the word now, like,
I think they enjoyed it because I think they felt things were relatable. I mean, I had the added advantage that I was, because I was English and because of the association with English football, they found it cool anyway. So the fact that they could say they had an English coach was a big respect winner from the off anyway. They helped me with my Norwegian, and I helped them with their English. But I think that I made a huge amount of mistakes the first 6 months of me being a coach, a humongous amount, which I know every coach goes through. But it was really my first, as much as I'd had roles as a grassroots coach, it was the first one in an elite setting, let's call it. I most definitely wasn't ready for it. I most definitely would have benefited of being an assistant first in that environment somewhere else before getting that role, because I was a bit too romantic with how I wanted to do things. And you can do that at grassroots level because you can get away with it, and you know, there's not the added scrutiny. But obviously, when you come to an elite level, there's an expectation, unfairly or fairly, from external sources like parents or such. Which meant that I had to learn quite quickly. And I talked about, obviously, the level of competence of the coaching group in that first year. Rui and George, who were the one from Sporting and the one who's now in Benfica, they were two massive helps for me that year. They were very open, very friendly. They were great mentors for me that year, in as much as everyone else was as well. The thing that I always have had from when I first started coaching to now is I'm really comfortable connecting with players first. So it's really important for me that players feel comfortable, feel at ease, and feel like they're in a safe and trusted environment. And I can't start working on football until I get that in place. And I found that has bought me a lot of time and a lot of credit, because people then understand that you care, and they understand that you don't see yourself as a higher authority. You see yourself as part of the group, and that you're trying to affect and help them. You're not trying to, you know, do things aimed because you get a power trip or because you're trying to prove a point.
And there's the famous quote, isn't there? I think it's they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah, and that's something
it says it all, doesn't it?
That's you know, I have quite clear values or core values, and clarity and honesty and vulnerability are three of my main ones, because I think that there's no harm in admitting mistakes. If you get something wrong, then just say you're sorry and just say, look, I got it wrong, I'm sorry, and we move on. If you try and cover it up and push it somewhere else or push the blame somewhere else, that's where, you know, players aren't silly, regardless of whether they're 14 or 24 or 34, they know when you're bluffing. Mm. I think when you talked about, they found it really refreshing. And the first year, the club went into a real financial problem. I said we obviously had not the best economy, but they had a real big financial problems that year, nearly went bust. So I went probably 5-6 months without getting paid because they couldn't pay me. But the parents were brilliant because the parents then basically gave, they used to do like cakes and coffee on a match day. And then they used to put all the money into the team's money pot to pay for things like kit and training fees and everything like that. And when they found out I hadn't got paid, they took some of that money and gave it to me and said, we really want you to have this because we really want you to stay. Because they felt that I was having a really positive impact on the players, and they didn't really want me to leave. And again, you don't get that if you don't show humility. It's frowned upon, but I had dinner at parents' houses, and I had dinner because they understood that I was on my own. I was 21. I was in a new country, and they found it really important that I felt safe and I felt comfortable, and they had their trust. So that itself showed me that if you're open and honest and try and just be yourself, then most of the time it works. So no, I think that was a very long-winded answer to your question, but the age thing definitely helped, but I also think that the situation helped in the fact that I was young and fresh, and as I said, I was trying to do my best, and that got me the credit and the time to begin with.
So it sounds like a great environment, you know, coaches who are willing to give you time, you know, people are learning, and also the parents as well. I mean, how great is that?
I mean, it frightens me to death that the players that I had in my first years there, they're now like 21. They're the same age now as I was when I first met them. And that freaks me out. You know, they've gone through university and gone into the military or started work, or and I look back, but I still get messages from the parents now asking how I am. And when I've got the job I got now, I got a lot that were sending me lots of messages of support. And whenever I'm down in that part of the country, they always really want me to go and see them and say hello and hear what they are. So, as I said, they were a special group, and it means a lot now that I still have the contact to do with them.
So fast forward to not where you are now, but where you were last year.
Yeah, so I was under,
with
I was
the youth team.
If you take
you?
The English title, I was lead professional face. So I had the under 19s, which doubled up as a reserve team, because in Norway, the reserve teams play within the league structure. So if you think like Spain with the B teams, it's a bit like that kind of structure. So I had the reserve team that played at the fourth tier of Norwegian football, but it was predominantly a 19s group. And then I was responsible for all the players 16 to 19 then, in terms of what happened on the pitch, but also which coaches were in which session, what we were working on, the macro cycle, the relations with school, the travel organisation, parent contact, etc., etc.
And how often did they train a week?
Pretty much the same as the first team. So they would have game, recovery, day off, and then would train four sessions into a game. So they would train six team sessions a week, and then there would be one or two gym sessions and maybe one sort of individual session, as they called it, per week. So you're looking at probably nine sessions total. Yeah. Or nine activities probably total, because obviously one of them would be a game.
And you were the the manager. So I was the one match days, were you?
For the reserve games, I was the one that led it. And then I had a coach with me who was, I don't really want to say he was my assistant, because he was more than my assistant. So he was my fellow coach, I'm going to say it like that. And then when we played national under 19 games, we would reverse roles. So he would lead the team and I would then take more of a back seat within the same, but we'd have the predominantly the same group of players.
So from going from the under 14 team, and obviously you took them to under 19s, like you said, in that time, then when you made the switch, I know we're always learning, in essence, but did you have quite an understanding of the way you wanted to play, the way you wanted to do things, the way you wanted players to
I had a middle step which helped with that. And when I left Follow in 2015, I got asked to become an assistant manager for a men's team in Norway, which is coincidentally the team I'm at now. But I was assistant manager when they were in second division, so there was third level. So I actually took an even bigger jump and went from 16s to men's football and kind of missed the under 19s out. And Norwegian clubs in general have a culture where the formation kind of sits at the top and then the playing style sits underneath it. I know in modern football, it's kind of gone the other way, where the playing style sits at the top. And the formation then just becomes an element of that. You know, you don't have to look at examples like Pep and that, where they flick between a back three and a back four and three in midfield, two in midfield, whatever. But we went into this club, myself and a guy called Gary Hogan. And we kind of, I wouldn't say neglected that, but we went in with how we wanted to play football. So we flipped, they played 4-3-3 before we arrived. We flipped the midfield and played with two at the bottom. We played with inside wingers, we played with high fullbacks. We wanted to play more of a progressive style, whereas they were used to perhaps sitting, being a bit more on a low block and countering. And we had a very mixed year where we had an amazing cup run. We got to the fourth round of the cup, so the last 16. We beat Molde in the third round, which was managed by Solskjaer at the time. And then we played Sarpsborg and lost 3-0 away. So in the cup, we got a lot of revenue and we got a lot of exposure. But in the league, we were very, very mixed. We were relatively good at home, but we couldn't win away for love nor money. And Gary was very much the traditional manager type. He was the type that would say what was in his head. And my job then was to get it onto the pitch. So when we had training sessions, it was predominantly me that led it. It was me that came up with the exercises. It was me that had to translate his footballing ideas into practice. And again, I was only 20, I turned 25 that year. So I was guilty of being like an ambitious young coach, which is wanting to get to the top as quick as possible and sometimes missing a few steps along the way that you have to fill in later on. And the one that I missed there was that I went from being an environment that was fully development based when I was 14 to 16, to then having to go into an environment where results were king. And I acted in a way where I acted how I thought a senior coach should act. So I was a bit more cynical, very much results orientated. I got extremely nervous before games because I was so focused on the outcome that I then forgot the process. And in the end, it came to a point where I turned round and probably October time and said, oh, I can't do this. I can't be in an environment for myself at the minute where results are king, because the biggest irritation for me was not losing. I could handle losing if we deserved to lose. The irritation was when I felt that it was a close game or we were a better team in certain metrics, but we would never get the result. So I felt like we had no justification of what we were trying to do. There's a lot of things I felt we did well that year, but we missed something, I think, on a emotional or psychological level, where we gave the players the trust and the confidence in that they needed. I think we changed a few things too quickly and too much. So we didn't get the buy-in from the players first before we start changing it. We just changed it without really explaining why that was.
So if I just try and reference you when you were with the under-14s to 19s, you probably sort of neglected a bit of that connection with the players, with the parents. Obviously not parents at that level, but you sort of screwed that up a little bit and were a bit more elite, weren't you?
I think I just went away from what I believed in. I think I acted how I thought I should act, instead of acting how I was.
Yeah. So in essence, you should have sort of stayed true to yourself, which I'm sure you did, which is a credit to you, sort of saying,
that's
I'm
pretty much what happened.
I'm not ready for this yet.
And it was probably the best learning I had, because it was probably the biggest, not failure, but the biggest thing to go wrong in my career to date. Everything before then had gone on an upwards curve, and that was the first thing that kind of made me go, oh, hang on a minute, this isn't quite as easy as I thought it was. And as I say, I have to use time to reflect and think and try and understand why it didn't go right, or why it didn't go the way I think it should have gone. And that's essentially how you learn. You can't. It's a lot easier to learn when things go wrong than it is when it goes right. So when I was
exactly
given the opportunity to go to Bordeglimt, where I just left now, at the end of that time, it was completely, there were two independent events of each other. I left, and then a week later they contacted me to go there. And I felt then that was a very happy medium, because it was back into a development environment with the 16s as it was at the time. But it was in an elite environment, which meant that the result does have some meaning, but it wasn't the be all and end all. So it was a nice one step back to go two forwards. And then I had 1 year as an under 16s coach.
Yeah.
1 year as an 18s coach, and then in 2019 I was offered the role that I've just described as a lead face. And in those 2 years then I'd had time to reflect, and one of the things that I reflected on was that, as I said, being true to yourself as a coach and your personality is one of the most important things. So when I went into that reserve role then, where results were of importance again, I had a mechanism and I had an understanding of how I wanted to do it. And I was a lot more democratic and a lot more inclusive in the way I coached the group and we managed the group as a group, which then meant that we had a successful year results wise, but we also had a successful year in terms of players getting exposure with the first team, in terms of players playing for the national team. We had two players go on trial at Brighton. So there was reward for the way we did it. And that was actually just being true to myself and getting the buy-in from the players that we had.
So when you went to that reserve team, essentially reserve team manager job, you were... You'd basically gone back to find yourself again, hadn't you, like you say? And then how did you fit in winning? How did you squeeze in winning with still coaching the way that you believe in?
You focus on the process. I can't remember the name of the coach, but there's a coach, former coach from the San Francisco 49ers. And the name of his book is The Game Takes Care of Itself. And the point of that is that if you get everything else right, if you get the training right, if you get the environment right, if you get the focuses right, and you work well enough, the result will come. you'll get the result and you'll get the game that you want. If you just focus on the game, you miss out everything else before that, and then it becomes hollow, because it might be you succeed for a period of time, but when things start going a bit astray, you don't have the foundations built underneath it to be able to maintain it. That's why you see a lot of, you know, managers that have the bounce effect, where they come in and have results because they just focus on results, and then they forget the laying the foundations. That's where again, personal statement, I think a manager's worth is not actually when they come in initially, it's when they have their first pre-season. Because when they had their first pre-season, that's when they can properly integrate their ideas into a team. And that's where you see then those that come in have a bounce effect, but after pre-season and into their first full season, they struggle, and then they end up leaving within 6 months. So that was predominantly where it was based from. We had a very clear focus orientation where we spoke about at the beginning of the year where we got promoted from the fifth level up to the fourth level the year before. So we'd sort of said, okay, it was everyone's first year at that level, myself included. My co-coach had been at that level before, so he knew about it. But we sort of went, right, where do you want to finish? And in the meantime, I'd sort of gone back into the history books and found out on average, how many points did we need? How many wins did we need? How many goals did we need? How many clean sheets did we need? How many goals could we afford to concede for every position in the table from first to 16th? And basically, they said, well, we want to finish here. And I said, well, this is what you got to do. You know, if you want to finish at that position, if you want to say we want to stay up, so let's say that it was 12th in the table. To finish 12th on the table, this is what you've got to get. You'll get these amount of points. You've got to average these points per game. You've got to get this amount of goals. So all of a sudden then, you had very clear metrics to work towards. And then when you were working in your everyday, you had something to aim towards. Yeah. So if you were doing a session based on attacking play and the quality of the... Or if you had focused on attacking play, the question you could ask yourself then was, how could we get our attacking play to be as good so that we can meet the targets we wanted? And what ended up happening was that after the first half of the season, there's like in Norway, there's a 2-3 week summer break. And at that point, we'd already got to over half the points we needed. So after the summer then, we sat down again and said, right, are we still going for the same goal, or are we going to change the target? No, we want to go mid-table now. Okay, well, that means now we've got to go from this to this. So they did their first one by about end of August. Then got the second one then by about the end of September. So then we had to say, well, what do you want to do now? And, oh, we want to be top five. Okay, this is what you've got to do then. So even though the goals were set and the goals were met, because we kept re-evaluating the goals and resetting the goals, there was always something they'd have focus on in training, which then meant that even going into the last game, we ended up finishing sixth, but there was 2 points between third and sixth. And unfortunately, the results went against us on the last day. We won, but so did everyone else. But it meant then that we went in with a clear objective. It wasn't like some teams that got to their objective and then they put the kids out or they rotate the squad. We played, even though everyone in our squad played, everyone in our squad played with a clear focus of what they were trying to achieve. And that's something that I hope to bring in now to my current job. And on the thing I've had to argue with myself a lot this year is that the Bodø/Glimt team of last year that were historic in many ways and smashed all sorts of records did it the complete opposite way and had no goals in their entirety. Their only goal was to be better than the last week. So every time they beat a team 3-0, they'd be looking at how they can get four next week. Or if they conceded a goal, they'd be looking at how they could get a clean sheet the next week. Or if someone had a pass percentage of 85%, they'd be working out how they could get 90. So they had such a developmental attitude that the result then was never, the result or the opposition was never a massive consideration, because they always felt then if they focused on themselves and made sure their every day was the best it could be, the result would then take care of itself.
I tell you what, I love that. I love their analogy, but also I love yours as well. Like, I mean, that's that. If I love player ownership, right? And that what you've just been explaining to me about Bodo, but also your team. You know, this was the goal we set, guys. What do you think? Do you think we're better than that? I love that, and that just shows that you are getting them to buy in, and it's a collective. It's not just let's just say Sam Allardyce, for example. Okay, just nothing against him. Let's just use him. You know, well, no. We've finished 17th. I'm happy with that. You know, and the way they've been playing, let's say the last two or three games has been really good, and they could maybe achieve a little bit more. I mean, in the grand schemes of things, maybe finishing 15th wouldn't do anything for him apart from maybe another 2 million for West Brom or whatever. But it's just, I love that. I love what you said there. It's so
they
good
are, but the most important thing is you have and to then make they're sure in control they, of they it, understand they? What that looks like, because being 17th in 2021 will look different to being 17th in 2020. I'll give you an easy example. The team I've just taken over now finished in the relegation playoff last year. And they had a point sum of 33 points, which yes. in the last 5 years is the joint highest amount of points to finish that position. So if they'd had that exact same performance in other years, wow. they would have finished higher in the table, and it would never have been a problem to think about relegation, never been a consideration. But for that year in particular, it was. So it's really important that when yeah. you talk about goal setting in terms of where you want to finish, you've got to make sure it's realistic to know what does that actually look like? What are you working towards? So for us this year, the league is going to be, I think, tougher for many reasons. I think one, we've got second season syndrome to try and counter. I think that the strength of the league is stronger this year compared to last year. Obviously, last year was a corona year, which brings up a load of anomalies anyway. But our goal is just to get 34 points. That's it. Yeah. We don't, you know, wherever that gets us, we'll worry about that when we have to get there. But if we get one more point than last year, and we try and score yeah. more goals than we scored, and we try and concede less goals than we let in, then that's a successful season. The rest will take care of itself then. And that's the metrics then. That's where the focus needs to be. You can have an overall goal of we want to stay in the league. That's, you know, we're open enough to say that. But you have to have some sort of tangible thing to own towards. It's all good giving players ownership, but they have to know what that looks like. Because otherwise you can have what I call a commentator's word, where you say the right things, but they don't actually have any effect or ballast behind them.
Yeah. Yeah. And also with, you know, if there's, it's a fine line, isn't it? If there's too much player ownership, and like you say, they could almost stagnate, and they've got to still be guided by you, haven't they, really? And I just want to ask, Can you tell me a bit about your overall philosophy as a manager now? Your beliefs, your philosophy, even your playing style?
My leadership style is one where I will be very clear when we're on the pitch, but off the pitch, it's a democracy. I can give you an easy example. We haven't got like a clear set of rules for the players. They're adults. We don't need to tell them, you know, this is what you have to do, and if you don't do this, this is the punishment. They're adults. You know, everything has a meaning. If you're late to a session and you haven't said, you're more just showing your character to the rest of the group than you are being punished. And we had an open meeting on Wednesday about expectations about ourselves.
Yeah.
And we did this exercise where we put the three values of the club on the board, which is loyalty, honesty, and humility. Sorry, I've translated it in my head. And I basically asked the group, what do those words mean to you? And we used this software where the players could write what they wanted on the phone, and it would pop up on the screen, without anyone knowing who had said what on the screen. So what it meant then was that the whole group could see what everyone in the group meant that word to them. So if they talked about honesty, it talked about it being, you know, speaking to people directly, saying what you mean, being brave enough to say it, no matter if you're 19 or 39, that everyone had the right to have their say. And when you have the same things keep coming up, then you have a group, the definition of that word. So it means then you can hold the group then to that. If you're, if we're saying that honesty is a key value of the club, we've defined what that word now means to us as a group. So now we have to live that. And we have to do that every day. And when we say we, that's not we the players. That's we the players, the coaching staff, the support staff, everybody. That's our definition now. So from one of my big things as a coach, first and foremost, is getting the environment right and get an environment that wants to learn, get better. And my job is to support that. I can't. I can lead it. I can step front. I can lead by example. Something I believe massively in, that I'm not somebody who gets special privilege because I'm the head coach. I'm just the person that has the final word or has to take the tough decisions or has to point the direction. I like to play 4-3-3. That's very heavily influenced in my last club, Bordeglimt, and also from other influences from football at the top levels. So Pep, obviously, it's 4-3-3, but it's not 4-3-3. It's all manner of things. And Barcelona of previous years and even the Chelsea of 2005 played a 4-3-3 in a completely different way, but the structure was similar. And my philosophy in general is I like to try and play the strength of the individual players within the group to find a balance. So, for example, I have what I call a holy triangle. And the holy triangle is the right back, the right winger, and the one of the two, if you're thinking like a point down midfield, one of the two central midfielders. So the, you have a left holy triangle and a right holy triangle. And my philosophy is that you build that triangle so that you have complete balance. So, for example, if you have a right back who is very attacking orientated, then you need to use that as a strength. But then you need to put the right midfielder and the right winger to complement that strength. There's no point having three players who are all very attack minded, because that's then when you get imbalance in a team and that's where you can get punished. If a player is, if you've got an X factor player who's exceptionally good at dribbling, you've got to put him in as many scenarios where he can go and do that and make sure that he has support around him so that the team then benefit from that X factor. So I don't have the, you know, I could talk here and say I like to play possession orientated, fast flowing, attacking football. And in principle, I do, but it doesn't mean that every team you see, see me coach is going to look exactly like that, because I might not have the players to do that. Yeah, they, you know,
and it goes back to the individual,
really
doesn't it?
But teams are made up of individuals, and you have to manage them all to get the best out of them. We have a couple of really, really good individuals. One of our striker was, I think, second top goal scorer in the league last year. Goalkeeper was a Trinidad and Tobago international, right back of Gambia international. So we have really top quality players mixed in with players who are, you know, the unsung heroes, but the ones that make the team tick. Like the captain, for example, he is a centre defender who leads by example. He doesn't necessarily say a lot, but he leads by example. The vice captain, the striker, he is the complete opposite. He will talk and he will lead and delegate and he will gesticulate. And but you need that balance. And I think that's where I believe then that you play players to their strengths and you try and you build a team. You don't put necessarily the best 11 players on the pitch. You put the best team on the pitch that's made up of whatever you have available. And it's like, you know, I'd like to try and press and be on the front foot and have players who are confident enough taking their own decisions and being on, as I say, proactive, not reactive. But I also like emotionally smart players. So, you know, if your team is on the back foot for a period of a game, then survive that period of the game. but be smart enough to survive it. And survive it might be that you might have to go into a low block for 5-10 minutes and just get your foot back in the game. And then when the momentum switches,
yeah,
then, you know, push a little bit more and attack a little bit more and use the momentum, then you build from there, which I think is at the minute is an underrated thing in football, but it is starting to come more into the game where, you know, that even though teams have 60-70% of possession, possession is now almost a dormant matrix, because possession can actually mean you lose the game because you are imbalanced or open. And if a team then can counter that in the right spaces, then actually you're opening yourself up to be hurt. So, yeah, I know it's a bit wishy-washy, the answers of how I like to play, but I think, and I have an 86-page document of how exactly I want to play in all the scenarios. But that's if I was playing, you know, if I could pick any player in the world and I could build a team from anyone, that I would use what's in that document. For now, it's a case of using that document plus,
yeah,
how the team have played and the players I've got, and then building it stone by stone to get perhaps in the end of the time of my contract closer to what my playing model is. But in the meantime, find the compromise so that you don't, as we learned in 2016, you don't change everything before you get the buy-in of the players.
No, I know it was a roundabout way of sort of giving me your sort of philosophy and playing style, but I really like it. I love that. It's sort of focused around the individual. And there'll be a lot of youth coaches listening to this. So I just want to ask you a question. Obviously, completely different context because first team is winning. But if you go right back to, let's say, grassroots, and you've got a player, I don't know, let's say his biggest strength is dribbling at people. So would you, I mean, there's always this argument, fix positions or rotate. What would you do? Would you constantly put that player in a position where he can be at his best, i.e. dribbling? I know you can dribble from anywhere, but
I think,
or would you
on
want him to experience at a young age different positions?
I think very early, we're talking sort of before under 12, I'd play him everywhere. Play him as a winger, play him as a central defender. Because if you play him as a central defender and he dribbles, yeah, the risk / reward is obviously a lot higher than if you play as a striker. Because if you get it wrong as a central defender and they score a goal, it can be quite risky, but it also helps the player to understand, well, why did it go wrong? And then your job as a coach then is to help them on that reflection, but also to encourage them to,
yeah,
keep doing it, even though they might concede another 3 goals from it, but it'll help them in the long run then establish the risk versus reward. When should I dribble? When should I pass? I think when they're in the 13-16s, I know of a lot of coaches that only ever focus on what they should improve. I actually think the opposite. I think you should work on their strength even more so that their strength becomes even stronger, but just make sure that the elements that are maybe not as strong are of a sound enough level that they can still participate within the team. So if you take your dribbling example, I would make that dribbler the best dribbler he can be so he can be the most effective in front of goal and get loads of goals and assists. It doesn't mean then that he's going to be the best defender. You know, it's very rare that you find someone that has the capability. And if you do, they're usually playing Champions League. But what you can give them then is you can give them the foundations of defending so they can do just enough to function within the team when defending. You know, it doesn't mean they have to be the best first defender. It doesn't mean they'd be at the best in the box.
Yeah.
But the fullback is a very classical example of that, because there are a lot of fullbacks that did not start as fullbacks. There's a lot of fullbacks that started as wingers, but didn't have the qualities or got to a point where there were better players ahead of him in that position, but got converted to a fullback because of their abilities to go forwards, which meant their defensive abilities then are only ever good enough, but it's never been their strong point from when they were 12 going forwards. So it's, for me, the weapon that a player has, particularly in the ages of sort of 12 to 19, really, you've got to make that weapon the best weapon it can be, and make sure then you expose the player then to other elements to make them as good as they can be, without necessarily making it the biggest strength that they've got.
I love that. And if I'm being critical of myself, I feel I was very naive when I started coaching, and I was, like you've just said, everybody else is. You know, they're looking at what that player needs to improve, and instead of actually making what they are really good at exceptional. And it's only sort of, I'd say, the last 3 or 4 years that I've actually realised, you know, if I can make him the best at that, then that's what I've got to do. And yeah, obviously don't neglect the other sides of the game, because they will need
and
that,
the other
like
thing to
say
on that as well, it's not
that's,
just the
it's
football.
Really interesting that
you know
that you
their
said
biggest
that.
Their biggest X factor could be their mental toughness or resilience, or it could be their leadership, or it could be their speed, yeah, or it could be their endurance, you know, the ability to keep running and keep going. So it's having the mindset of looking what they can do, not what they can't do. You know, most coaches are, it's very quick and easy to see what they can't do, because that presents itself perhaps more often because it doesn't fit the picture you have in your head. But if you can look at a player or a game or and just go with as open mind as possible and see what they can do, then that's then when the magic really happens.
And you need a mix, like you said, you need a mix of everything. You might have a slower player who's not, you know, not as able to get around the pitch, but he's got amazing leadership
absolutely
qualities.
And that's,
so
that's
he's
as much of a
he's vital
then,
in
as
that
it
aspect.
Is being able to go past three players and put it in the goal.
Yeah, yeah. So when you took your role, you're going to be going
we
into
start
the season.
6th
is
of
it
April.
February? Or
it's the first
no, sorry, it's is it March it starts? 6th of April. So are you looking to integrate any academy players into
yes and no
into your first team,
gone
or have
a process
you already?
Now where we've put all our energy on what we have already, rather than what we necessarily need to get in. So we've had 3-4 under-19 players with us for the last 3 weeks, and we've had a couple of other players that have come in who are, we've got one left back at the minute who's training with us, who's 18. We've had a winger who's 19 who's come in and trained with us. We've got a goalkeeper coming in on Monday who's 20. So we have a mix at the minute of young and old. If I was being critical, I think we have perhaps too big a mix. I think we have at the minute what I call a bookended squad, where we have a lot of established players, sort of late 20s, X hundreds of games and sort of know the ropes. And we have sort of a lot of 19, 20-year-olds that perhaps are potential but don't have the games. We don't really have that sort of middle brick where they're between, let's say, 21 and 24 and maybe have had 100 games at a decent level. We haven't quite got that calibre of player which we need to look for. But the long-term plan is to integrate some of the younger players we have now into the first team. But it might not be this year. And I think the key thing for this year is going to be about mapping what their progression looks like. So if I give an example, we've got a right back who is 19, who played, I think it was 12, 13 appearances in the first team last year. And he signed a new 4-year deal a month ago. Now, his aim we've given him is to be the starting right back by the beginning of next year, because there's some elements in his defensive game we know we need to improve if he's going to be an established, stable member of the starting 11. So it's up to us then as coaches to map that year then for him to make sure that he gets enough exposure in the first team in games, that he's playing enough minutes and he's getting exposure, that we use the time in the next 12 months to work on the elements of his game that we feel we know what his weapon is and we're working with that. We need to just get his defensive side a little bit higher and his mentality to almost make him think he is a senior player now instead of being a junior playing with the seniors, which is a different mentality. But we've given him a clear plan over the next four years of how we'd see it being. We have a couple of other players. We've got a striker who's in the same bracket, and we've got a central midfielder who's in a similar bracket. And we've got a lot of players who, we've even got six or seven players that were still here from the last time I was here. So that's made the transition for me a lot easier. And the intention is just basically to, as I say, to get more points and be better than last year, but to try and get that identity that's important to the club and try and get those youth players closer to the first team. Because last year the development was very much affected by Corona. The match platform was taken away from them. Some of them only had one 90-minute game in an entire year. And, you know, that you can train all you like, but if you don't play games, you don't get that exposure and experience that you need in a more open and challenging environment. So it might be for them, we have to prioritise that at a different level than it is being a squad player, because that's what's best for them. And that's going to make this year an exciting year for many reasons, because we have to, my main aim is to lay the foundations then for what the rest of the years will be. And that's using the experience I've had way back in my Fulham days to what I had in Follow to what I had in Bordergame the last 4 years and try and make it work. But the first impressions have been really good. The first conversations and input from the players have been very, very good. We've had some disrupted weeks for training because of the weather, where we've had some pitch problems. It's been icy. Temperature's been minus 15 or minus 20, which means it's too cold to train outside. So we've had to train in like a 9-a-side hall, which is, it's good to train, but it's just not the same as 11-a-side for obvious reasons. We've had friendlies cancelled because of Corona. Mm. And we're a little bit unsure how they're going to be over the next coming weeks. So there's been a lot of uncontrollables at the moment that we can't control. And, you know, I'm human, so there's been days where I've been frustrated that we haven't been able to do what we wanted to do. But the players have responded very, very well. I feel we have a good connection now within the group. I feel like we have a good relationship between the coaching staff and the players. And I feel like some of the ideas that we've discussed and have worked on have started to come out in the games we've had, like the internal games we've had. And it's still 8 weeks till the season begins. We've still got plenty of time. We're still in a good position. Everyone's still fit at the moment. We haven't got any major injuries. And those that have had major injuries are on the way back, which is good. There's a lot of things that are positive with us at the moment. But as I alluded to earlier, it's going to be a tougher year this year than it was last year. And we just have to roll our sleeves up. We've already been written off by the media. We've already been told that we haven't got a chance. You've got a head coach who's second youngest in the league. You've got a squad that is potentially worse because we've sold one of our best players to a team in the division above. We haven't replaced him yet. So a lot of people have written us off for that. We've made no signings at the minute where other clubs have made four or five. So there's a lot of reasons to write us off. But at the end of the day, we are good enough. And from a personal perspective, I have enough belief in myself, the players and the people I work with to think that we can have a good season. But it's up to us. We have to, at the end of the day, when the first whistle blows on the 6th of April, we have to be ready.
Yeah. And your relationship with the club, have they given you like some aspirations?
They've given me a long contract, which
they'd like to
which
get
actually
to
was
in
a huge surprise,
the coming years
when it was offered, because I wasn't expecting it in the slightest. But what it gives me is security that they have a lot of belief in what I want to do, and I have understanding that my job is a little bit beyond just managing the team now, but it's about planning for managing the team near the end of the contract in terms of the pathway of getting players up from the under-19s, the recruitment around the team, the generation shift that's soon going to have to happen. They, at the moment, if we are being yeah. honest, we have a Oberstliga team, which is the first team, but we're a second division club, which means that the rest of the club is having to catch up with the first team. The first team, when I left in 2016, they got relegated. So they were playing at the fourth level, then got promoted straight back up. They then were 45 minutes away from going straight back down. They were winning their game, but the other game needed to go the way. The team that they need to lose were winning 3-0 at half time. So everyone thought it was over. That team then lost 4-3. So they stayed up by a point, I think. And then out of nowhere, they won the division, which they hadn't planned for. No one had planned for. But they sort of had a really good first half of the season, then went for it in the summer, and it came off against all plans. They built a brand new stadium because the stadium they had didn't meet the regulations. They built a brand new stadium in 10 weeks. It's got undersole heating. It's full-size pitch. It's got floodlights. It's got enough. It's a nice, compact little Conference North ground is the best way I can describe it in English terms. But it's brand spanking new. It's not even a year old yet. So, you know, I've got my own office. Yep, it's got a massive meeting area. Change rooms have got all like TVs and an ice bath and modern showers. And so it's a club that is growing extremely quickly. And it's now at that point where it's like growing pains when you're a teenager. You grow really quickly and then the rest of your body has to catch up. And that's where the club are at the minute. The first team has grown really quickly, and all of a sudden the rest of the club then has to catch up. It has to become more stable, and you know, last year was a massive step towards that by staying up, and this year is an even bigger one to staying up again, because if you can get past the first 2 years, it's quite common then for you to establish yourself year on year. So yeah.
As a nation, do Norway put a lot of money into their football?
It's a very communal feel in Norway. So the towns that the club represent tend to get very much behind the club. So quite a lot of money that's generated is done by sponsorship, and it's usually by a lot of companies that are based in that town. So if you take Bodø/Glimt, where I was at, the local bank was their main sponsor. The local supermarket was another big sponsor. Another relatively big company was another sponsor. But it's all sponsors by local, not local businesses, but local branches of businesses, because they have that real affinity then with the town. So I remember that there was quite an infamous interview here from my assistant who took over the team last year at the end of the year. And the Eurosport commentator was very negative towards Blink and made a lot of analyst comments, shall we say, without really getting to know the club in their opinion. And he had a big rant at the end, basically saying about he's going to go home to his kids and he knows where Santa Claus is because he's a Swedish guy in the studio down in Oslo. But he said at the end, this result is not about Stjørdal Blink, the club. This result is about Stjørdal, the town. And everyone in the change room, myself included, has done this to represent everyone in the town and show them that a little place like Stjørdal can compete with the big boys. And that pretty much sums up that feeling. When Bodø/Glimt won the title, it was the first time a team in the north of Norway had ever won the title in Norwegian history. And I think there's a record somewhere that says that Bodø/Glimt are the most northern champions in Europe now. But not a team in Europe that have won it in a more northern position in Europe. And when they officially won the title, they landed in the airport. And I cannot tell you the thousands of people that were lining the streets. I would love to say with face masks on during Corona, but that wasn't quite the case. But they lined the streets. And they kept saying that there were so many sort of older people that were there, dressed fully in yellow, with a massive glint flag, in absolute floods of tears, because they never thought, and it wasn't about, again, it wasn't about the club. It was just about the fact that north of Norway and Border had won something, and there'd been such a historical racial issue between the north and south in Norway, where in the 60s and 70s, you weren't even allowed to, you know, people would rent out their apartments in Oslo, but wouldn't allow people from the north to rent because they felt they were almost outcasts. So for them then to have that affinity of a team winning the title and representing them, that is the big core of Norwegian culture when it comes to football. And that's then where the money is generated, because a lot of local businesses then buy into that.
Wow, it's fascinating, isn't it? I just to finish, I mean, it's been amazing, some great insight, but I just want to take you right back to something you said when you were under 14 coach and you were offered that job. Now, you said that predominantly it used to be they'd stay in their grassroots clubs, let's say, and then under 16 they'd go into an academy.
It's changed slightly.
You said that changed. Why and what
now
has changed?
Sort of found a middle ground where it's acceptable for teams to start having elite teams from under 13s. So a lot of clubs now in the top academies will start their youth or elite youth from under 12s, under 13s. And I think part of the reason was that the Norwegian academy system came into play in 2017, which is very much similar to the impact the ECCC had in England, where academies in Norway then were graded based upon a lot of differing factors. And one of the things that was introduced with that then was the development of follow-up of players from 6 to 19 and then integration into the first team. So because it became a more acceptable thing then, because they realized that in Europe then that it was you need to specialize early to get players to at the level. And again, you've seen the Norwegian boom now with Brede Haaland and Ødegaard and Sander Berger in Sheffield United, and there's one more I can't think of. Jens Petter Hauge, of course, in Milan, who's from Bordeaux. That's why I can't believe I've just forgotten him, but we'll forget that. But the point is that they have then benefited from having that system starting earlier. The reason why they've set it at sort of 12, 13 is because they feel that it's linked a little bit to when they change school, but they also feel that that's a time where players are conscious enough of their environment that they can actually make that choice almost for themselves, that they're old enough to say, well, I really want to be a footballer, and therefore can start taking those steps. Whereas at the ages of 6 to 12, albeit that it's a golden sort of framework for players to learn, and that's where a lot of teams have been very good to integrate high quality coaching, but within the grassroots environments, the social side is such a big thing for a kid. We spoke earlier about how safety and trust, and for that age group, fun is the most important thing. Then what they then do is just basically let them have that environment, but they do things on the sides that help clubs then influence their learning, influence their development, and also basically be aware of them. So they do things like after school clubs, they do things like, I wouldn't call them development centers, that's unfair, but it's like an invitation thing where a club is allowed to invite two players from the under 12s to go and have 10 extra sessions if they want, and they do it on like a rotation basis. So two will go for the first 10 weeks of the year, then another two will go for the next 10 weeks, and another two will go for the next 10 weeks. So everyone gets exposure then to a bit extra if they want it, without it just being for the best. And like I said, there's a lot of clubs now I've got a lot of really good projects and work that goes into play with those 6 to 12, so they can have the contact with them without taking them out of their environment unnecessarily. And I think that is most definitely the way it should go. I think it's most definitely the best learning for children and for kids, because most, if you ask a kid what they really want to do, they just want to play football, and most of the time it's with their mates. They want to play with their mates, and at that age group, that's more important than playing with the best. Yes, that you'll get some that are more competitive than others. You'll get those that don't like losing. You'll get those that they can't stand not scoring. But that's not the most important thing at that age. We've just got to expose them to it a little bit. But as I say, when they start to get sort of 11, 12, and they get a bit conscious about the world, that can be a good time then to sort of show them the other side. And as I say, the system has proven that if you do the groundwork in that 6 to 12 right, then you can still make players that are good enough.
This episode is brought to you by Play by Matrika Sports, the fundamental tool for every coach and analyst. Create and manage all your video analysis in one platform, from coding the game to player sharing. Play by Matrika Sports is the most intuitive and easy-to-use platform out there. It can be useful not only for football, but to any sport or individual that wants to improve performance and utilize video analysis for that. Code key moments of the game, analyze and share them with staff and players. It's free, and any team in the world is able to cover the whole workflow to improve team performance. Code, visualize, and present in just a few seconds. Create your free account now at matrikasports.com. Play by Matrika Sports, the power behind the game.